Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The COVID-19 pandemic had a massive effect on just about every major industry, from businesses to medicine to travel. With a rise of Zoom and a fear of illness in those first few years, the pandemic made business travel nearly obsolete. Now that the worst has passed, business travel is back to business as usual. But there have been some important changes. Joining us to tell us about the new world of business travel is Wired reporter and senior editor for Special Projects, Angela Watercutter. Welcome to All Sides, Angela.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how have airlines and airports tried to attract customers back to planes? How did they get over the pandemic fears and say, come fly with us?
I think a big thing was they sort of brought back or souped up what we think of as business class, you know, especially for business travelers. There was this idea that you get business class and you get like an inch and a half more leg room, right? Or, you know, you kind of get a slightly nicer meal. But since the pandemic, a lot of airlines have really brought back more luxurious business class where, you know, you maybe have a suite or you have even additional legroom, or maybe even a full lay down chair so that you can sleep on your flight, which you probably want to do after you've spent a week on the road for your business trip. There's also better offerings in terms of, say, suites or access to, you know, those very exclusive lounges. So you have a place to kind of put your feet up in between your flights or on your layover. And there's been just sort of a lot of making business travel sort of like fun and exciting in that kind of Mad Men sort of way that it wasn't maybe right before the pandemic started.
So many airlines have been notorious for offering Wi-Fi that doesn't work very well. How has it changed in recent years? Because I have to imagine they had to get better at that.
They definitely did. And, you know, for years, Wi-Fi on a plane kind of depended on where your plane was flying and if it happened to be within, you know, range of a tower. But now with satellite internet technology, a lot more flights are equipped with much faster and much more secure Wi-Fi in terms of how well your signal stays with you throughout the course of a flight. So now that all of us got used to Zoom meetings, we can now do them from the plane, even though I think you're maybe technically not supposed to. There are better connections with Wi-Fi when it comes to in-flight service.
That's what I was going to say. I think that people used to like to hide from their Zoom meetings and say, oops, I'm on a flight. I can't join the Zoom call. But now you could join the Zoom call from the plane.
Right. I think during the reporting of this, one of my colleagues was like, but, you know, I liked that I didn't have to be online, or, you know, that I could just sit and, you know, type and not be reachable on Slack or something during my flight. But now the other side of this is that there's a catch, and that's it's making you always available for business travelers.
I mean, if you can stream a full action movie, you could probably get on a Zoom call, right? We have to just admit that.
Yeah. If you're on TikTok, you're also on Slack. That's just how it is these days.
Yeah. Your piece for Wired also highlighted the better technology that can keep a plane in the air longer. So how are we able to make these longer flights?
Lighter materials, better design when it comes to wings. I think that there's just been a push towards, you know, making planes that are sleeker and faster, and like they don't necessarily have to be the Dreamliner kind of flight, but they do have to be able to make those flights more quickly.
So making them more quickly, but also being able to stay in the air longer and be more comfortable on long flights, has that been a part of it too? You mentioned business class having more leg room, but like a lot of airlines are having some fancier planes here and there.
Yeah. There's definitely more amenities, more like suites on flights, you know, where you can have, you know, use slippers and caviar and all those kind of on those long business flights. Yeah.
It makes me think of how Europe has their trains and there's certain train cars that are fancier than others. Are planes going to start to adopt that model where there's some that are more comfortable than others?
I think so. And I also think that, like, we're going to have a different range. It used to be, you know, first class, maybe a couple business class seats, and then the rest of us in coach, you know.
Yeah.
I think now that there's like a broader array of business class, or, you know, classes that are sort of in between, where you can get a few more amenities or a little more comfort on your flight, and have that sort of be a middle area. I think that a lot of flights and a lot of airlines are trying to find ways to sort of meet every kind of traveler where they are, whether they're business or people going on vacation.
Part of the reason air travel was avoided during the pandemic was the fear of the recirculated air on a plane, and it could carry germs and the germs would just linger on the plane. How have airlines worked to combat that issue, or at least that perception?
I don't know. I think a lot of it is just, obviously cleanliness is top of mind, I think, all the time, but also, I think the more that it happens, the more people travel and kind of get from A to B without getting sick, without getting, you know, sort of anything. It just sort of, it kind of, I think, teaches us how to travel the way that we remember doing before COVID hit.
Yeah, I can remember a flight I was on recently. Like, you know, it used to be that when you stepped on every flight, you got like a sanitary wipe so you could wipe off your own seat. And
yeah.
A flight I was on recently, I needed to wipe something off because it wasn't clean. And I asked the flight attendant for a wipe and she didn't have any. And I was just like, yeah. I was like, are we that far removed from the pandemic that we just don't care anymore?
Yeah, I remember, you know, there was a period where I was like, well, I'm never not wearing a mask again, you know, and like now I still do, but now I'm looking around and I'm like, I might be the only one, you know, like there's just sort of, it's a much different thing. But, you know, I think it's also seasonal. I feel like when we travel this year at the holidays, perhaps we'll be more masked up because there's that idea of like, you know, you go and you gather with family and everybody's coming from all over the place. And so there might be additional concerns with that again this year.
Yeah, it was funny because she did eventually find me a sanitary wipe. But I was on an American Airlines flight and it was a United wipe, and she handed it to me and said, "Don't tell anyone." And now I'm telling everyone. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about changes to the business travel industry with Wired senior editor for special projects, Angela Watercutter. So there's also more technology in other parts of a work trip. Your series highlighted a pretty unique hotel experience in Japan that involved a disturbing number of robots. can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so the chain is called Henna. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But yeah, it's a small chain, mostly in Japan, although there are similar hotels in the States where most of the staff are robots. There's some that are actually dinosaurs. So I guess if you want a Dinobot to be your concierge, you can. But yeah, they've just sort of kind of made a, you know, what maybe would be a bug to some people, a feature, and turn the act of like doing a lot of the sort of front desk services over to robots who can like do the basic things like make sure that you get your morning wake up call or adjust the temperature in your room or, you know, address things like, yes, your Wi-Fi service or something like that. And so it's really created this, you know, kind of interesting experience for travelers, business or otherwise, who want to kind of, I guess, feel like the Jetsons, you know, like live in the future and have their hotel experience sort of buttressed by the presence of robots there to help with their every need.
Is this a pure Japan thing, or do you think that we'll see it other places eventually?
I think the novelty is there that it will kind of carry over. I don't know if everybody wants that sort of novelty. You know, like I think that some of us actually want a person to, you know, help make the bed or clean the room or what have you. But But I do think that there is sort of, there's something interesting about it, you know, just having, having robots be there to check you in and get you set up in your room.
Have robots, droids, or at least AI been incorporated into the air travel industry? I'm sure airlines have to be using AI somewhere. Do you know?
Yeah. You know, I haven't done a ton of reporting on that myself, but I do feel like there has to be something just even in terms of like, you know, how many flights you should do here or how many flights you should do there, and whether we're over-indexing or under-indexing. There have to be all sorts of things that somebody's trying to figure out how to use AI for in this day and age.
Do you also feel like AI is trying to make work trips easier, from the booking to the dealing with all the reimbursement paperwork on the back end? Can AI help me with that?
There are apps that will kind of help you get through the sort of slow and unfun process of expense reports. No offense to expense reports. I know they have to be but yeah, there are apps that can kind of help you track what services you're using and what miles you've traveled, and kind of clock all those and keep them all together for you, so that when you get to that part of filing all your expenses, it's not maybe quite as hard as it normally would have been.
Your business travel series that Wired did was very extensive, had lots of different parts to it. What do you think overall? Like, do people still want to just stay at home and have a Zoom call, or do they want, is business travel back? Is it back and better than ever?
I think it's back. I think it kind of largely depends on the person and their line of work. We collaborated with our colleagues at Condé Nast Traveler working on this, and they have talked to a lot of folks who kind of make business travel sort of part of their, they have made it part of their work-life balance, right? Like, yes, they have to travel a lot, but they try to, tack on an extra day to go to museums, or like they have a ritual where they, wake up and do yoga and then have, a coffee at the hotel bar or something to, kind of start their day. Like, they sort of have made the travel part of it a enriching part of the work experience. And so, like, I think that there are a lot of people who like really are invigorated by that, and like the travel helps them with their jobs. And so I do think that there is a lot of attention being paid to that, and hotels are trying to cater to that, and airlines are trying to cater to that. And so there has been a bit of a resurgence in sort of business travel and what business travel is, rather than, the airport hotel and the kind of rental car sort of ideas that we think of for a lot of business travel.
I read in one of the pieces that there's a trend of combining your work trip with a vacation. So I guess these work trip places need to be at nicer locations, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and like some really high-end, people with, really high-end jobs kind of do end up, a lot of companies now are doing like rewards travel. So like if you have the most sales in a quarter or something like that, you get an exclusive vacation to a place you maybe wouldn't have been able to travel to otherwise. So yeah, I think there's a lot of perks like that kind of coming around.
Have you found anything about airlines competing with each other to obtain customers? Are there certain airlines doing it better than others? Because for a while it seemed like the cheap airlines were the way to go, but now those keep merging. How are airlines competing, and is someone going to win, I guess?
I think from what I remember, working on this series, it seemed like Delta and Delta One was really kind of the one that was maybe pulling out just slightly ahead, because like they do have a lot of lounges and other sort of services and airports, especially in the US, that kind of cater to business travelers, and they have a lot of, different sort of business premium kind of seating for those travelers. But that's this week, like that's this year. Next year, United could come to the front, and there's a lot of international airlines that are, bringing U.S. travelers abroad for their international travel. So it will change over time, I'm sure of that.
Do you see that that businesses are wanting their people to travel? Because like a Zoom call to me seems a whole lot cheaper than paying for like a flight and a hotel room and all of this other stuff.
Yeah, one of our colleagues at Condé Nast Traveler wrote a story about this. And yeah, it was definitely a thing of somebody had made a comment that there was going to be a sort of renewed interest in this the first time that somebody like actually flies to the business meeting and lands the deal. Like you can do a lot over emails and you can do a lot over Zooms, but sometimes when you can go and meet somebody in person and, get the contract or land the deal or get a new client, because you went and met with them in person, I think businesses will sort of see the value in that. And so yeah, there could be a real a real uptick there.
Well, we're just about out of time. Is there a favorite part of this special project that you did that I didn't ask you about?
No, you hit it on. You hit on it when you did the robots.
Okay, the robots were your favorite part. Yeah.
One of the first things we agreed, like, yes, we're assigning that story. And also it was maybe the most fun to work on.
Yeah, you have to go to Wired and look at the pictures of the robots. It's a little unsettling, but also maybe cool. Depends on your view. All right. We've been talking about the business of air travel and business travel and where it's heading with Wired reporter and senior editor for special projects, Angela Watercutter. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about online communities and where some young men get lost in them. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The online world is complicated enough in adulthood, but how can millions of communities, hundreds of thousands of personalities and influencers, and an endless stream of content impact some of the more vulnerable? Boys and young men have been the target of online extremism and conspiracy, preying on a sense of loneliness and a want for belonging. What can be done to help children stay away from these harmful communities? And what are the signs to look for if you think your child might be starting to join these groups? Joining us now is Julie Jargon, a family and tech columnist for The Wall Street Journal, who recently wrote three pieces on the topic called The Boys Are Not All Right. Welcome to All Sides, Julie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your reporting mainly focused on boys and young men. Do you feel, and in your research, have you found that boys are more susceptible to the bad corners of the internet than girls?
Yeah, there is research that shows that boys and young men are more targeted and more susceptible to these kind of dark corners of the internet.
Do we know why? Is it just loneliness, or what are they looking for that maybe girls are not looking for?
Well, I think boys and girls are looking for oftentimes the same kind of things, but maybe in different ways. But you know, the young men that I have talked to told me that they were searching for a sense of belonging and a kind of a sense of adventure that isn't always permissible anymore in their estimation, and so the online spaces have become kind of some of the place where they can roam freely and find other people that might share the same beliefs and provide a sense of excitement in some regards. But that can lead to some not so great places for them. You know, I was talking to one young man who had been in a conspiracy rabbit hole for a long time and came out the other side, and he described boyhood currently as a void, and he said that the thrilling extremist ideas you find on the internet become your surrogate boyhood adventure. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really powerful way to describe what's going on here.
Is there anywhere in particular they're finding these extremist views, these chat rooms? I mean, is it coming through certain apps, or is it video games?
It's really everywhere. I mean, people can enter these spaces from a number of places. Online video games is one way, Discord servers where a lot of gamers end up talking. But there are YouTube videos, TikTok videos, Reddit posts. There's a number of different avenues where young men can fall into these different pipelines.
You wrote that after conservative activist Charlie Kirk was murdered, and then when you read that the suspect was a 22-year-old young man, it struck you as a stark reminder that young men are struggling. Tell me about young men and finding belonging, and what that made you realize whenever you heard about the suspect in the Charlie Kirk murder.
Yeah, and it wasn't really just that particular case, but there's just been, one situation after another, whether it's a mass shooting or boys or young men, having, doing suicide attempts, and oftentimes what parents or authorities find is that these young men were in some sort of internet space that was not a healthy place for them to be. And so that is what kind of got me thinking of, well, where are these young men congregating online? What are they looking at that might be fueling their anger or their frustration?
Yeah, you mentioned the anger. So it's not just that they're finding community of like-minded or even conspiracy theories that like change their mind about something, but they're also finding rage. Is that true? They're finding a lot of anger and hate.
Yes, there is a lot of anger and hate, and in some of these communities, they are, young men are encouraged to blame other people for their situation, and so there's a lot of sort of victimhood that goes on, that may initially make young men feel like they're being recognized and that they're, that it's not their fault that they're maybe in the situation that they're in life, that it's someone else's fault. It may be women's fault. It may be the fault of other groups of people. And so that kind of fuels the anger that they might have already been feeling towards others and externalizing the circumstances that might have brought them there in the first place.
Do any of the influencers or the online personalities that are kind of preying on these vulnerabilities, do they get monetary gain out of it? I mean, are people making money here?
Oh, sure. Online influencers that are successful and have high view counts for their videos and also sell products, whether it's, books or merchandise, certainly see financial gain from building a following and creating a community of people that are gathered there for, similar reasons. So yes, there's financial gain to be had in tapping into communities like this.
Do you think some of these circles and these rabbit holes is it all purposeful, or does sometimes even for the person who starts it, does it get out of control? Like, does everyone know what they're doing? I guess is what I'm asking.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, people are drawn to these communities for different reasons, and then when they get there, I guess they're, maybe they go there with a purpose, or maybe they just are looking for a sense of belonging, and then they stumble into it. And sometimes it's, something that the algorithm feeds them. And so it may not necessarily always be that boys or young men are seeking out these spaces, but they might see a recommendation for a video in their feed and out of curiosity, click into it and then kind of become absorbed into that world. So, but as if you're asking if it's purposeful on the part of the influencers, probably, because we all know that negativity tends to do better on the internet than positivity. Just more clicks, more, especially the conspiracy kind of videos. Those just kind of feed on each other, and one video kind of leads to another. So, yeah.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about harmful online communities with Julie Jargon, family and tech columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Have you done any research into to race? Is this mainly young white males who are susceptible to this mostly, or are you seeing it across other races?
I didn't do a whole lot of research into that, breakdown of what kinds of men are in these groups, so I can't answer that for sure.
Do you know what the biggest platform is? I mean, we talked about a few of them, but like, is it TikTok, YouTube, Reddit? You mentioned Discord. Is it kind of an all of the above, or is there one place more highly influential than others?
Yeah, it's hard to quantify, what platform might be more influential than others. And I think it's sometimes, people are in multiple platforms. They're not just in one space. They might start off in one space and migrate to others. So it's kind of all over the place.
And the problem can begin in middle school and high school. And middle schools and high schools have to adapt rapidly to wide-ranging problems with the internet and its effect on kids. Do you think schools should be implementing some sort of special programming? Should there be a class in school about the dangers of the internet?
I mean, yes, mm-hmm. I think that that would be really helpful, and some schools do, but a lot don't. Mm-hmm. And there's just such a range of dangers online, whether it's extremist groups or extortion or any number of harms that kids just aren't aware of and that parents don't know about. So education schools could go a long way toward raising that awareness of what to look out for and what to be aware of.
I guess if you're not going to educate the kids, maybe the parents need to take a class. So in your report, you point out a list. You have a list of things parents should be on the lookout for, warning signs to know if their child is maybe getting into a rabbit hole that they might have trouble getting out of. So I'm just going to list them, but then we can go through a couple. So it's social withdrawal, loss of interest, increased irritability, concerning social feeds, and other changes in behavior. Those are all signs that your son might be influenced by harmful pipelines. So can you tell me, how does a parent know the difference between normal increased irritability just because they're a teenager versus when it's dangerous?
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to tell. But one of the warning signs is, you know, if it's a constant state of irritability. I mean, mm-hmm. we all have bad days and teenagers can be irritable quite a bit. But if they become, you know, like verbally or physically aggressive towards family members, friends, and others, that's definitely a red flag. If they totally outright dismiss their parents' viewpoints, I mean, it's obviously normal and natural to have some healthy debate between teenagers and parents on things. But if they're, you know, if they're more irritable than normal. And usually, you know, parents know their children and can tell if there's something different and something feels off. So if something feels off, it probably is.
And then you also, you talked to someone who was trying to give parents advice on how to wade into this with their kids. So what are some ways that parents can try to get their kids out of these dangerous pipelines, or at least learn what is happening? Can you give me a few of the tips that you listed in your one piece?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's a turnoff to kids is when you go in and try to be the authoritative figure and say, you know, don't be on this platform, it's bad. You know, that's going to, you know, put up a wall. So one approach is to kind of play dumb. And you know, even if you know about some of the platforms that your kids are on or might be on, ask them, you know, kind of let them inform you about the online spaces that they're inhabiting. Ask some open-ended questions like, you know, how does Discord work? Or explain to me why this meme is funny. And that is a way to kind of get them talking and explaining their world to you in a way that might open a door if you do hear something that's concerning, to kind of ask further about it.
Yeah, that idea of playing dumb, I feel like some parents won't need to play dumb. They really don't know. Like they're asking, how does Discord work? I don't know what that is. Tell me what you're doing, right?
Exactly.
Will the teenager want to explain it to them? Or if they don't, is that another warning sign if they don't engage?
Yeah, that could be certainly a warning sign. And then, you know, one thing you can do in that situation is try to give your teen some sense of control. Like if you're concerned and they don't want to open up to you, you know, you could say, look, I think there's something going on here. I think you need to talk to someone about it. And if it's not me, you know, I want you to choose someone that you can talk to. So giving them some agency in the situation and saying, you know, if you have maybe a difficult relationship with your teen and they're just not going to open up to you, say, you know, would you talk to your older brother or your uncle or your coach or your teacher, you know, some other trusted adult in their life, let them choose who that might be and try to encourage that discussion.
Is taking away a device, like kind of grounding off the internet, turning off the Wi-Fi, is that a bad move?
You know, there's mixed feelings about that. I mean, certainly if there's a dire situation and you need to remove them from it, that might be what you need to do. If you just say, I'm taking this away, and maybe there's no imminent harm or anything, that could exacerbate the situation and make it worse and make them feel like they have nowhere to go. You know, if their world and their friends and their community are all online and you just take that away, I don't know that that's solving the problem. But in extreme situations, it might be warranted. So just that's kind of a case-by-case basis.
And one of the other warning signs you listed is concerning social feeds. Can you tell me what you meant by that? Because I would think that a lot of the social feeds, the kids, the parents can't see them, right?
Yeah, I mean, this would rely on your child opening up to you to some extent. And if they're, you know, in that conversation where you're saying, hey, explain Discord to me, ask them to show you the servers they're in, and the, you know, their feed on X or Reddit, or, you know, ask them to show you like what groups are they in. They may choose to hide some of them from you and not be open about it. But if you know what accounts they have and you can follow, you know, their social media feeds, see what they're posting, see who they're following, who's following them, that can give you a clue as to whether they're getting into some sort of fringe groups online.
Is there a balance, though, of you don't want to take it all away? Because what if this is your child's friend group and they've found some really good connections there and you're not sure how, if it's bad necessarily?
I mean, and that's where I advocate for taking a look at the devices themselves, because if they're not going to be honest with you and kind of open the door a little bit, I do believe it's your parental right to take a look at their phone or their computer yourself. And
one of those, you know, like I pay for it, so you have to let me see it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, there's a fine line between their right to privacy and your responsibility as a parent. So everybody has to kind of figure out how to walk that line. But if there's something really concerning, I mean, that's your kind of your obligation as a parent to really understand what's going on. And maybe you won't find anything concerning, and that would be the best case scenario. But I think it's fair if they're shutting you out and they're not showing you something when asked, then that suggests they might be hiding something, and that there's something they know you'd be unhappy about if you saw. So, you know, if there is something that's worrisome and you're getting that gut feeling that there's something amiss, you know, you might just have to look at their devices and then decide how to handle the situation if you do see some concerning content or you know, concerning posts on their part, you know, that could come back to bite them later.
Just to end on, rather than being reactive, what are some things you would say to parents so they can preemptively help their children stay away from these dark corners of the internet?
Yeah, I mean, I can't emphasize enough just having conversations early and often. And especially as kids are younger and they're starting to get online with, you know, their own devices, or they're starting to have social media accounts. I mean, of course, if you delay social media as long as possible, then you can, you know, wait till their minds are a little bit more mature to absorb what they're seeing online. But even if they already are online, it's good just to have frequent check-ins with them. Like, what are people talking about these days? What are people saying about the Charlie Kirk situation, or what are people saying about, you know, other things in the news? And their answers to those questions might inform you as to what they're seeing. You know, if they're talking about conspiracies around different events, or they're talking about, you know, they're speaking in a way that makes you worried about them being exposed to sort of hateful content, you know, those are points where you can talk some of that through and say, you know, you can't believe everything you're seeing online. There are a lot of theories out there on different things, and you have to take it with a grain of salt. You know, everyone's weighing in and trying to get clicks, and half of what you're seeing is not even true. Mm-hmm. You know, just having those conversations, it's not a one-time conversation. It's like, you know, with my kids, it's like kind of like an everyday kind of conversation, mm-hmm. like just part of asking about your day at school. It's kind of like, what are you seeing online? What are people saying? What are the memes people are sharing? And just folding that into kind of your natural everyday or weekly kind of conversations with your kids is a good way to stay on top of things.
I want to thank you for your time today. We've been talking with Julie Jargon, a family and tech columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And coming up on Tech Tuesday, we're going to be talking about Amazon's October sale, Prime Days, and also the future of the Xbox Game Pass. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Whether you've been eyeing a new TV or a new laptop, or you want to do some window shopping online, Amazon's October Prime Days start today, and we're here to tell you about the biggest deals. Joining us now is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
So I feel like it's always a Prime Day now. I don't know. Do they have a lot more of these?
It really wasn't all that long ago that we were talking about a Prime Day happening in July and how it was 4 days long and you know, lots of stuff going on. But we are now in October, and this is when Prime Day used to only happen this time of year, which is this kind of period before we get to talking about Black Friday. But this event is only 2 days, specifically today and tomorrow.
All right. So what is the goal of this Prime Days, Prime Day? I don't know whether to pluralize it, but it's 2 days. What is the goal for Amazon here? Are they trying to entice people to do early holiday shopping?
Early holiday shopping is definitely a significant part of it. But I also, you know, taking a look at the you know, selection of things that are on sale through Amazon's partners and you know, competing sales at, you know, Walmart and Best Buy and places like that. There's not really a rhyme or reason. There are a ton of things that are just sales on, you know, basic home essentials, you know, like brooms and dustpans are, you know, at some of the lowest prices that I have seen for this year, which is, you know, kind of an odd thing for me to notice. But yeah, a lot of tech is on prices that are below what they were before, you know, tariffs started seeing them increase. This is particularly true for Apple products. Everything from, you know, like AirTags and AirPods to MacBooks are on, you know, some of the lowest prices that have been for this year. The one area that there isn't a giant drop in prices is televisions. And that's almost assuredly because those are the things that are quite popular for Black Friday.
Is there anything in particular you personally are going to be picking up during the sale besides a broom?
The biggest thing actually for me is making sure that I am stocked up on batteries. Though we haven't talked about this a ton, but there have been a couple of reports from toy manufacturers throughout the last couple of months that are saying that over the holiday season, a lot of really popular kids toys, in order to save money and cut back on some of those tariffs, are not going to come with batteries. So like my one big warning to folks who are looking to shop right now is make sure well before your holiday shopping starts that you've got, you know, some of those basic essentials like batteries on hand, because they may not be there like they have been there in the past.
Are you saying batteries are going to get more expensive, or are they going to be a scarcity? We're not going to be able to find batteries.
I think batteries will be fine. They just likely won't be as cheap as we get closer to the time of year when people are buying things that will need batteries.
Okay. I already think batteries are expensive, so I don't know.
That is also true.
So do you feel Amazon does these Prime Days more often now? Do they just like look around their warehouses? Well, they don't look. They use AI. So AI goes around the warehouse and says, we have way too much of this. And that's what they put on sale.
I'm sure that that's certainly a part of it. It's also, you know, partnering with the retailers that have their own stores on Amazon and making sure that they are, you know, kind of submitting things that are available. Amazon's clearly been trying a couple of different things this year. The July Prime Day, like I said earlier, was 4 days long, but it didn't really seem to move the needle for Amazon a whole lot. It performed basically the same as it did when it was a two-day event, which Amazon is kind of learning the hard way that there is, in fact, a ceiling to how many people are willing to, you know, kind of spend money during these shopping events and what they're willing to spend money on. And so this event is quite a bit more rolled back, and I think, you know, correctly so, in preparation for, you know, the actual holiday shopping season.
Is there any urgency to any items? Do you think that something like you mentioned Apple products, will they sell out?
It's not likely, but it's not impossible. You know, I think the biggest thing to keep in mind isn't necessarily at Amazon, but in places like Walmart. In particular, one of the things that Walmart did at the start of their competing sale for this event is make it so that anyone who is a Walmart Plus subscriber had access to any of those sales 6 hours ahead of anyone else. with the appropriate notification for that. That is a really good indicator for how Walmart's going to behave when it comes to Black Friday. So if they have a TV or something that is on a particularly good deal, the subscribers are going to be the ones that get access to that first, and that can severely limit other people's ability to get a hold of those products.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content for CNET. We're going to move on to the Xbox. So Xbox users may not have that same frugal luxury as a simple Amazon Prime Day sale. Microsoft has hiked up the price of its widely popular Xbox Ultimate Game Pass from $20 a month to $30 a month. Why this jump? Why do you think Xbox is making the Game Pass $10 more expensive a month?
This is actually the second significant price increase that Microsoft has put on its consumers this year. The first was raising the price of the consoles themselves, citing tariffs. Each version of the Xbox increased by $100 earlier this year. And one of the big kind of savings from that was knowing that if you had Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, you pay $20 a month, and when new games come out, they're just immediately available for you to pay. So that you don't, spend the extra $70, on that title, and you can play for as long as you want, as long as you're paying for that subscription. $20 a month is something that, was kind of agreed to be quite, reasonable for the volume of game and content that you're getting with that. $30 a month is a massive increase, and Microsoft's audience responded almost immediately by unsubscribing in really significant waves.
That's what I was going to ask. Do we know how many people subscribe to the Game Pass Ultimate? Do they release subscriber numbers?
Microsoft doesn't release specific subscriber numbers, but people who make games and put them on Game Pass say that Game Pass, gives them, they get a cut of that monthly subscription. And those game developers say overwhelmingly that Game Pass is significantly successful for them when they release games on that platform.
Now, we are a Switch household, so I don't use Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, but is it a good deal? Was it a good deal at $20 a month? But who decides if 30 is too much?
It was a solid deal when it originally released in 2019 for $15 a month, and it has slowly seen these price hikes. $20 was perfectly reasonable for the Ultimate version, depending on the kind of games you play, not just because you could play games, without having to pay for the full title and decide whether that was something you like, but you could play it on basically anything. Game Pass Ultimate allows you to play those same games on a computer or on your phone, or you'd be able to kind of take that anywhere, and that was something that really made that subscription worth it. $30 a month is basically the cost of half a game, and being able to pay for that every month at a time where everything else in a lot of people's lives is getting more expensive is a difficult ask.
Yeah, I mean, all streaming services seem to be going up. Whenever I turned on my Hulu, there was a price increase. Netflix had a price increase. So it just isn't this just the way to do business? All businesses decide to increase the price at some point.
Well, I mean, we're looking at, very, very few things in our day-to-day lives that don't have some form of subscription service attached to it now. And that was born out of a belief that a lot of people sign up for subscriptions and then don't cancel them. They forget. And so that what seems like a very small, thing that you're paying for just kind of racks up over time. There's an industry term for it. It is zombie subscriptions. Those make a lot of companies a lot of money. And so by increasing those prices, you very quickly remind people that they're paying for that thing. And it gives them a choice.
Okay, so I would consider myself a zombie, but then as soon as I get that little box that flashes that says, oh, by the way, next month this is going up, then that reminds you that you have the subscription. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it. So it wakes you up from your zombie status?
That's right. It reminds you, oh, hey, I'm actually paying for this. do I really want to be paying more for it? It is a thing that happens really frequently. And it was something that Disney Plus as well saw recently after increasing their prices. There are a lot of folks, who decided that was kind of the last straw for them.
So you mentioned Microsoft got some backlash. They had people unsubscribe, or at least say they were going to.
Right.
Do you think that they'll change it, or are they? I should they have grandfathered it in and let some people stay at the lower price and done it just for new people?
There are quite a few people who had the ability, quite some time ago to buy Xbox Game Pass in year-long increments, and those folks won't see price increases in many cases for 18 to 24 months, depending on what they bought at the time. So there is a subset of Game Pass players that are going to be unaffected by this by for a while. So really, it's going to be up to the next month. This is expected to take effect starting November 4th. So as we move into the holiday season, it will be really interesting to see whether Microsoft decides to delay this a little bit based on the audience reaction, or keep it this way and decide that it's worth the loss.
We are going to move on to another topic, which is Google has unveiled its brand new Google Home ecosystem, showcasing better cameras, better integration, more upgrades, more updates. So, what are Google's biggest new releases when it comes to their smart home technology?
The biggest thing that Google's currently relying on right now, there's one big software change and a couple of interesting hardware changes. The hardware change is that the cameras that they have been releasing for a little while under the Nest brand are gaining some additional intelligence to process things in low light, which is really important for home security cameras, is being able to to function not just in an infrared mode, but be able to get fine detail when all the lights are out. And this is something that Google has lagged behind a little bit in for the last little while. The demonstrations that we've seen so far indicate that these are very nice cameras that work really well in the dark, but we've yet to be able to put them in our lab and compare them directly to the ones made by Ring and some of the other third parties for this sort of thing. The software that goes along with this, I'm sure that this will surprise you, is very heavily leaning into AI.
No kidding.
Google is taking its Gemini platform and moving it into what it is calling Gemini for Home. This is going to be something that you will notice if you are a Google Home user, not in the way that you change the way that you wake it up, because that's going to be exactly the same. And I'm going to try really hard not to use those combinations of words, just like I do for Amazon's version of this. But the idea is that when you use that wake word in order to gain the attention of the smart home equipment, that the software behind it is going to be running this new Gemini at Home. Which is supposed to operate a little faster and just give you a ton of additional options depending on what pieces of hardware you have in your house.
Yeah, Russell's saying he doesn't want to wake up people's smart speakers who are listening to us right now. But it's instead of saying, so right now you say, hey, Google, right?
Right.
You don't have to say, hey, Gemini. Is it the other way it'll still
Correct. Yeah,
work?
that's not going to change. The way that you use this is still going to function the way that you want it to. There, in some cases, will be a different voice behind it. But a couple of the things that Gemini enables these platforms to do is remember things in order in which you have asked for them. So if you say something like, hey, I would like you to turn the lights down in this room, instead of waking it back up and starting another conversation, you can just say, hey, you can just turn them off. And it will contextually remember that the last set of instructions you gave were about this light over here. And so it will apply that context and turn it off without having to give a more robotic version of that command.
So, is Google leaning more into Gemini? Because Gemini AI is replacing the whole Google Assistant. Is that right?
This appears to be, yeah, this is a wholesale takeover, kind of piece by piece. This is something that we have seen added to browsers and to Google Drive, its Office platform. Android phones are now fully in the Gemini framework. So Google Home is really kind of one of the last places where Gemini wasn't fully integrated.
And are they doing this to streamline Google things, or is it to compete with other smart home technologies? Did Google need to do better?
It's definitely both. Google and Amazon have been, kind of the two biggest competitors when it comes to smart home hardware. And these two companies have been, kind of at it for quite some time, neither one of them being particularly successful at being able to take out the other, because Amazon is able to compete on price. And Google has the advantage of your phone, in many cases running Android. And so, there's a level of integration there that isn't possible in an entirely Amazon-based ecosystem.
Now, you mentioned that you haven't had a chance to test the new cameras for the Nest system, right? Because are they not out yet? They're just talked
We've
about.
seen some demonstrations, but they'll be released here in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. And does Google also have a new speaker they're coming out with, right?
Yeah, so every year they release a new version of their home speaker. The last couple of versions, it has been a very simple looking orb that you can hide somewhere in a room and have it not look like a piece of smart home tech, so that you can have it somewhere on a shelf or something like that, and not have it immediately draw someone's eye. And this year they've released it in four different colors, including a very, bright kind of orangish red. That kind of seems like it does the opposite of not drawing your eye to it. But yeah, the idea here is that these have an array of really powerful microphones in them that make it so that once you have tuned it to your home, that you don't have to shout, even if you're in another room, for that speaker to hear you and start working. And they will work with quite a few of the accessories that already exist, which is really important for folks this time of year that have the little Jack Skellington orb that goes over top of it. And so yeah, there's a lot of new, kind of software functionality, but visually these look very similar to Google's smart speakers from the past.
Is Orange having a moment? Because Apple has an orange iPhone, and now you just mentioned an orange new Google speaker, and Taylor Swift is all orange. Is this just the
This is
orange?
apparently the year that we are all big fans of Orange. I'm really curious to see whether that actually bears out in sales, although anecdotally, I have seen quite a few people with these new Orange iPhones already.
Same.
So,
That's
you know,
yeah.
it is this maybe this is maybe 2025 is the year of Orange.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Russell Holley, the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.